Angie has made it easier than ever to hire high-quality pros to get all your home service jobs done well. Just bring them your project online or with the Angie app, answer a few questions, and Angie will connect you with local pros who match your specific needs. Or book a service instantly at an upfront price. So join the millions of homeowners who use Angie to care for their homes and get your next home service job done well. Download the free Angie mobile app today or visit Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I.com.
A great documentary
makes us question everything. The things that we know and the things we think we know.
But we're actually completely wrong about.
This is the beginning of my last act. In order to know how to go forward, I'm going to have to know where I've been.
The public figures we love.
And love to hate.
The issues that we must face as a society.
Huge cultural moments.
I mean, as a black man, you're born into this world with PTSD.
Things you can't unsee.
The aftermath is worse than the actual levees breaking.
Someone who's different from us, but also
not that different from us.
Somebody offers you $1 million, you're gonna take it.
Documentaries show us the worst
and the best
of what human beings are capable of.
We all have exactly the same goal: get me a safe and effective vaccine as quickly as possible. We're just scared that science will be steamrolled.
Welcome to HBO Docs Club, where we dive deep into the true stories that captivate our imaginations. I'm Brittany Luce, longtime documentary superfan, freelance journalist, and cultural critic. You may know me from my other podcasts, For Colored Nerds and The Nod.
And I'm Ronald Young Jr., audio producer, live storyteller, film critic, and cultural commentator. You may have heard me on the podcast Solvable and NPR's Pop Culture Happy Hour. During each episode, we'll take a closer look at a film or series in the HBO documentary films catalog. Sometimes they'll be from our recent past, other times they'll be brand new, but they'll all inevitably teach us something about the human condition.
So today we have the documentary, How to Survive a Pandemic. This film, directed by Academy Award-nominated director David France, follows various players in the race to develop and distribute a COVID-19 vaccine.
I feel so fortunate and happy to have served and helped. That's all that counts. I say two vaccines approved by all standards. This is absolutely exceptional. Absolutely exceptional. And I think it was done uniquely on the basis of science, of data, of commitment to hard work and transparency. This is all has been achieved between May and now. We're not done.
In this episode, we sit down with David France and learn more about making a documentary about a pandemic during a pandemic.
I don't know if we were ever honest with anybody but ourselves about it, but we were just going to shoot until there was a solution, you know? And if that took 3 years or 4 years, we were just going to embed.
And then we'll talk with Father Paul Abernathy about using his faith to help his community in Pittsburgh make informed decisions about the vaccine.
You know, because I'm not an epidemiologist, I have no background in public health. You know, I'm a priest, I'm an Orthodox Christian priest. But what it is that love has made me a quick learner.
And also, as a heads up, this is typically where we would give you a spoiler warning for the episode. But as this documentary covers the COVID-19 pandemic, I think it's pretty safe to say that you have already been spoiled and that even if you haven't seen this documentary, you will get a lot out of this episode. So continue listening.
Okay, so Brittany, let's start off by recapping the documentary.
How to Survive a Pandemic starts with the emergence of the coronavirus in 2020, and it follows the spread and also watches researchers and scientists as they investigate and conduct trials with volunteers to come up with a new vaccine. And at this point, I'm sure you all remember, a new vaccine within, you know, a year of learning about a virus, that was a pretty tall order, like something we're used to now, but
wild.
It was a really tall order at that point in time. So throughout the documentary, we're watching death tolls rise. We're seeing people on lockdowns. These scientists are working on lockdown the same way that a lot of us are at home. And political pressure is growing as people are looking for solutions and definitive answers from scientists as to how to go about solving this huge problem of stopping the spread of COVID-19.
The documentary goes into 2021, and that's when, you know, the vaccines are starting to show promise and impact. The trials are coming out. They're putting out news about the trials. And the documentary goes into the obstacles, like systemic injustices, which countries are going to get the vaccine first, and then what's happening as variants start to arise. And I think kind of serves as a living record for understanding the relationship between scientists, researchers, politicians, pharmaceutical companies, frontline workers, and us, the common folk, all just trying to survive, just trying to do our thing.
Yeah, I mean, I think that thinking about it as a living record is exactly right. It is a huge, almost like bird's eye view snapshot of what was going on in the world and within the world of, you know, science and medicine, but also just in the world that we all live in at the time that this vaccine is being developed. It's really quite an achievement, and it's really given me a completely different appreciation for the vaccine that I have.
So, Brittany, tell us more about getting that vaccine you're so grateful to have. What was that like for you?
It almost felt surreal. My fiance and I went one morning, and the military was running point on the entire operation. Like, you know, the actual room where I was vaccinated was a City College gymnasium, which looks like a high school gymnasium. And there were all these military personnel running around in these little sort of like walled off, like little curtain cubicle little things. It basically just looked like a giant infirmary with a bunch of seats in the middle. And yeah, I mean, they asked me questions and, you know, finally gave me the jab. I forgot to put on my engagement ring that day, and the person who gave me my vaccine actually flirted with me. And I think part of that is just because people have been locked down for so long. And I was like, wow.
You better shoot your shot, homeboy.
I mean, I'm basically married, but I appreciate it. I mean, first of all, it was wild to see that many people. But also, it was after witnessing so much government inaction and just such a tepid response from the government, it was incredible to see the military mobilized, like to see an arm of the government mobilized to do this thing that was so not just like life-saving, but at that point, it just felt life-changing. Like getting the vaccine was the thing that allowed me to be able to see my parents and hug them for the first time in over a year. It felt like a first step toward getting back to some sort of normal.
Okay, so mine was pretty similar to yours. It was at a high school. And I remember one of the reasons that I wanted to get vaccinated was I got vaccinated in late February, early March, I want to say. And the reason why I wanted to get vaccinated was because I'd went through a breakup in the previous September. And I found out through multiple channels that she had gotten vaccinated. And I was like, oh, I'm not going to be the only one not out in these streets.
Oh, Ronald. No. It wasn't for science and the good of man. It was pettiness.
It was. All of that is true. All of that is true. But it's like also part of me, there was a visceral reaction to like, oh, so I'm going to be stuck in the house? So, it was just like yours. I went to the high school and I'm in there and we're spread out. You're right. I didn't even think about the fact that there's all these other people. And the first time I had been around this many people. So that was incredible. I sat down and they gave me the shot. And I think two parts that stand out to me was one, sitting in the waiting area with everybody else. And I'm wondering if we're all having the same thought, which is like, man, we might be done with this. This might be almost over. Like this is the beginning. Is this the beginning of the end of this? And then the second thought was when I went and sat in my car, I put on A Lovely Day by Bill Withers. I put that on and it was like starting to get a little springish here in the DC area. And I had to take a long drive home and I played that. And I'm just like, man, you know, so it felt like that felt like a giant step forward to saying like, all right, let's get this summer popping, guys. Let's get it together.
Yeah. I mean, you know, we were stuck inside, but many other people like essential workers, but also researchers, scientists, specifically scientists, and the ones that were depicted in the film, they were like busier than ever.
Yeah. I like that part of the documentary of them showing all of these folks using Zoom to solve problems. And some people had to be there in person. You know, a lot of scientists were essential personnel. They had to go out, they had to do research, they had to actually conduct trials. And I think looking at how everyone responded to the pandemic and watching as people made adjustments in their communities. The documentary highlights one of these adjustments from Pastor Abernathy, who was leading a community response team, as he was calling it, which was calling the people from his church and the people in his community and trying to keep them mobilized, keep them safe, give them information about the vaccine. And I thought it was so interesting because at one point, Pastor Abernathy quotes a scripture from the Bible, and it kind of goes into the importance of doctors and the importance of them being in this position to solve the problem. So I really liked how this was pointed out in the documentary. For me, it kind of just solidified the or clarified the fight that was happening between people, misinformation, their faith, all of that, and science. Science was like the real, it's the protagonist along the whole time.
Well, you know, it's interesting you bring up this idea of like science being the protagonist and everything else being potentially against it in this film. It was really incredible to see in How to Survive a Pandemic interviews that the director did with people who were anti-vax and with people who were, you know, denouncing Dr. Fauci for wanting them to take serious safety measures that have been proven to save lives. It was so wild to see how far the science had come that we were in a position of privilege to be able to have the vaccine trials as quickly as we did, to be able to develop a vaccine. It's really wild to see people who have fallen prey to anti-science and anti-vax propaganda used some of the same sort of protest aesthetics, you know, picketing signs and having demonstrations places where they don't want to wear masks or, you know, hanging, you know, dolls of Dr. Fauci in effigy.
I think the documentary does a good job of pointing out how the scientists, how they had to navigate these obstacles, because I think politics were the biggest obstacle. And it felt good to watch several interactions in this documentary, including one where there's an anti-vaccine protest or anti-mask protest in which a guy is wearing a hat that says F Dr. Fauci. And reporter John Cohen asked the guy in the hat, why are you going after Dr. Fauci?
Why fuck Dr. Fauci?
What did he do? Yeah. I think we deserve a second opinion.
Why? Why say fuck a doctor who's telling... He is a doctor. No, I'm not talking about... He's wearing a fuck Dr. Fauci hat. I'm asking him why.
I don't even know if we really fully understand how damaging all of that anti-science propaganda has been, because it's a barrier that's kept us from getting life-saving vaccines or life-saving measures to people writ large. And it's just devastating to see how people are fighting that.
This scientist becomes the lightning rod for all of the anger. Everything that we want to talk about, any frustration that people have about COVID is going directly at the scientist. My heart went out to them in a way that it kind of went out to essential workers. Mm-hmm. These are people who have done their jobs for decades. And here they are in a conversation with a person, and they're going in back and forth with them about whether or not the vaccine is actually viable, is actually helping people, or if it's swelling people's appendages, whatever.
As you said, David France spoke with anti-vax protesters. He spoke with doctors. He spoke with scientists, researchers. He spoke with people, which I thought was so important, like people like Pastor Abernathy. He spoke with essential workers in places like Brazil. Like, he was global with it in a way that I thought was really, really important. You know, there's a woman, Dr. Glenda Gray, who was an activist for HIV in South Africa. She's somebody who's dealing with, you know, one of the uglier parts of this entire vaccine distribution process, right? Where she's not necessarily in one of the rich countries that's getting a Pfizer or Moderna vaccine, and you can just go to your Walgreens or make an appointment with your doctor or CVS or whatever and get it. You know, she's dealing with one of the poorer countries that is not getting as much vaccine. And he did such a good job of tracking so many different people on so many different sides of this. He found a way to humanize all of these people. In my mind, I'm like, there's superheroes, you know what I'm saying, who are in these labs and like they're just like genius machines getting all this stuff to happen. But it's like, oh no, like all of these people just like us have families or are tired, are fed up, are feeling frustrated or feeling isolated and lonely. He really humanized all of these researchers and scientists in a way that I was like, whoa, I hadn't thought of them that way. What did you think?
There's one scientist there who has his laptop perched on top of those oatmeal cans, and he has a big stuffed bear in the background.
We do need to make sure that people trust in this and feel confident that what comes through our process is something, because we at FDA are comfortable giving that vaccine to our families, they will feel comfortable giving it to their families. And I'll stop there. Cans get to go back to their home for another day.
And you look at that, you're just like, scientists, they're just like us.
Yeah.
Like, we're the same. After breaking down our thoughts on the film, we got on the line with David France, director of How to Survive a Pandemic.
It placed me in time a little bit. Like, when in the pandemic did you start working on this project?
Well, we began our obsessing in March, mm-hmm. like everybody yeah. else, right? And we started filming in April. And
wow.
so we were filming very early. We were filming with mm-hmm. scientists who would let us film with them, but wouldn't let us in their house. So our first couple of shoots were through open windows.
Oh, wow.
Right? Because they wanted us to know what they were doing, but they knew it was too dangerous for anybody to come into their homes. And the last thing in the world we wanted was to make one of these like frontline scientists sick.
Yeah.
Right? Because yeah. they were doing the work that yeah. we all needed done. Mm-hmm. And we weren't going to get in their way. But they were gracious enough to let us, you know, spy a little bit at first. And we eventually got in once we understood the power of PPEs, right? And on all of the non-pharmaceutical interventions, as they started to call them, masks and gloves and gowns and the like. So then we started doing kind of Ebola-style gowning to get into people's homes after a while. But initially, it was through the windows, and which meant that we could only feature people whose offices or homes were on the ground floor at the time. Like, nobody in a high-rise building.
You say things changed over time, like with the PPE and stuff like that. Were you all able to travel even to all the places where the vaccines were being made?
In fact, we did not travel. For the most part. I mean, I traveled for the first couple of shoots just domestically in a car, sleeping in the car. I was afraid to go into motels and the like. But after a while, we concocted these methods to do the filming remotely. And we went through a period of R&D for robotic cameras. But people wow. were so nervous about this thing zooming around in their laboratory that everybody kept staring at it, or like they were afraid for it when it tried to make corners and missed the corners. And it didn't work. And we should have dedicated the film to those scientists in that lab specifically, just for allowing us this experimentation. But what we did in the end was to hire micro local crews. So if we were shooting mm-hmm. in Geneva, we'd hire a Geneva crew. If we were shooting in Durban in South Africa, we would hire a Durban crew. And so we weren't moving anybody even from city to city. We've developed a system, and I think other filmmakers have found a way to do this as well, to use Zoom as a way to be able to direct from here, from in my home. I was able to see the monitor was projecting through Zoom, so I saw what the camera saw. I was able to see the room because there was always a PA whose job it was to carry me around on an iPad. So there was like my face. And so I was able to ask questions and talk to people and engage people through that Zoom screen. And then went for sit-down interviews, they propped me up like some, you know, futuristic two-dimensional being. And that's how I did the interviews.
You mentioned that you started shooting in April, mm-hmm. and we know that the estimates on how long the lockdown and the pandemic was going to last, it kept changing in real time. So how long did y'all plan to shoot for?
It's a really interesting question. And I don't know if we were ever honest with anybody but ourselves about it, but we were just going to shoot until there was a solution, you know? Mm. And if that took 3 years or 4 years, we were just going to embed. And that's the promise that we made to like all the major pharmaceuticals that we went to. I have been a longtime science journalist, and I have been reporting on the race for an HIV vaccine for over 30 years, you know, and they still haven't found a vaccine. As many examples as they've tried and as many trials as they've funded and stood up, there hasn't been anywhere close to a successful vaccine against HIV. And my worry was that that could be true also about the coronavirus, that we'd all still be terrified of one another in the ways that we were in those first days of the pandemic.
Talk to me more about what your driving question was in reporting or documenting this story. Like, what was the question that kept you going and helping you shape the story?
You know, if we're going to get out of this, as somebody says in the film, it's going to be science that's going to get us out of this. And we were in a period politically and culturally, not just in America, but across the world, where expertise is doubted or challenged or otherwise denigrated. And yet it was going to be experts and nobody else that we were going to look to for some solution here. And that's what I wanted to do. I wanted to find these folks. They're not typical movie stars. They're scientists. The work they do is incomprehensible to most of us. But I knew what they were carrying, the load that they were carrying. And that's what I wanted to go and find and to be with them while they're pushing all boundaries and trying to bring us vaccines as fast as possible. And I wanted to be able to say, in the end, whether or not what they did was right. Did they cut the wrong corners?
How did you get, you know, so many scientists to be able to open up, but also to like communicate in a way that made it possible for someone like me, maybe who hasn't taken a science class in about 20 years, to understand?
Well, that's so interesting. Just as you were saying that, I was reminded on one of my previous projects, I interviewed a scientist and she said the joke among scientists is, you know, somebody says, well, why did you choose to become a scientist? And the answer is because I didn't have enough charisma to be an accountant. Right? So that's the joke they tell on one another, which is really sweet. But they knew what I knew, which is that the world was counting on them. And I think that's what allowed them to open up and to talk the way they did about sometimes their own lives, sometimes about the work that they're doing, and to let the rest of the world know what got us through this. And that was a generosity of spirit, I think, that shone in so many of those scenes.
Good news. We made it. Yes,
that
you submit the FDA as soon as possible.
Whoa. To life.
To breakthroughs.
Actually,
breakthroughs.
This celebration is really to life.
It's 5:59 and I just woke up to Slack messages, emails that Pfizer has reported its first interim analysis, and they found 90% efficacy.
So you mentioned, and we know you made a documentary and wrote a book about the AIDS epidemic. How did that affect how you approach this story?
Well, you know, the first thing I thought I wanted to look for was activism. Mm. And in HIV, and certainly the first 15 years of that pandemic, there was a movement that came about of citizen scientists, really, who stood up and demanded audiences with the actual scientists, the credentialed scientists, mm-hmm. and insisted upon being like partners with them in the solution. And I wondered what was going to happen in activism in COVID. And that's what I started to look for. At first, what I was surprised to find is that activism was coming now from the scientists themselves, that they were the people who were using the lessons from HIV, lessons about urgency and ethics and engagement and equity, using those lessons in today's pandemic and trying to chart a course that recognized the errors of the past and tried to avoid them this time.
So, David, what public health mistakes do you think were made during this pandemic?
Obviously, the mistake that was made principally was the one of the chaos coming out of the Trump administration. And although my film is not about that at all, it's the background noise that challenged the scientists and the scientific community to their core. And, you know, could they hold ground against that kind of political involvement and interjection and chaos, really. And could, you know, everyday citizen keep their eyes or keep our eyes on this goal? And obviously, we have today across the globe a large and really upsetting number of people who are suspicious of the vaccines and refuse to take the vaccines. We see what it's done in our country alone for perpetuating the pandemic even, and the pressure on hospital systems continues to this day because of that. And so that's a problem. I think and hope that if people see what actually happened when they watch How to Survive a Pandemic, they might feel a little more confident in who was doing this work and how it was being done and how it was being regulated and monitored and tested and safeguarded. And if from the very beginning we had been able to pull back the curtains just a little bit on that kind of orderly response to the pandemic, I think maybe we would have had many fewer people who were sitting out the solution and thereby creating all these additional problems.
I wonder though, like, you know, while so many people were obviously motivated to do good, right? To save lives. Like, not just save your own life, but to save the lives of, you know, all of the other billions of people on Earth. But I wonder, like, where's the line between the motivation to advance the science of the vaccine and to test it and everything like that versus also, like, the inevitable fact that there are pharmaceutical companies who stood and still stand to make a lot of money from the distribution of these vaccines. Mm-hmm. Like, how did you think about that?
Well, that was certainly something I wanted to keep an eye on, you know, because that did happen in HIV, right? We saw people who developed drugs to treat HIV in the early days who muscled out competition and sought to wring as much money as they possibly could out of the marketplace for those drugs, even though they were life-saving drugs, pricing them out of reach of most of the world. And I wanted to make sure that if that happened again, that we would track it. And you talk about the volunteers. You know, there are 1.5 million, 2 million people who just signed up for these trials around the globe because, as you know, for no money, but because they wanted to help humanity. It would be so wrong for that kind of dedication and volunteerism to be exploited financially by big pharmaceutical companies. And yet, we saw that happen, unfortunately. We saw many of the drug candidates say that they were going to go to the marketplace at no profit whatsoever, at a nonprofit price, but not all. And some of them were extreme in their unwillingness to price their candidates at a price point where people could afford it around the world. And unfortunately, that slowed down and really blocked the original rollout to the rest of the world. This is not just a consequence, I hate to say the word just in this context, of people dying in other parts of the world because they don't have access to these vaccines. The fact that we left for a year or 18 months large parts of the globe unvaccinated is why we have the variants that came back to bite us today. They come from those enormous pools of people who are getting infection after infection, and that's what opens up the potential for these viral mutations. That's what gave us Delta. That's what gave us Omicron. And unless we address the rest of the world, it could give us even more disastrous variants in the future. And that's a consequence of us not being equitable in our rollout of the vaccines.
Wow. The dangers of capitalism aside, the documentary has a much more hopeful tone than I think all of us expected. Was this a choice to make the tone intentionally hopeful?
I have made only a small handful of films, and they all focus on heroes, right? People who have done heroic things when you expect less than that from them. And I think that that's a huge part of the soul and character of this film, that people really did do the right thing and that science really did find a solution with these vaccines to a pandemic unmatched in 100 years. And that is really an amazing story.
Well, David, thank you so much. It's just such an honor to talk with you, having taken in all of your work and your legacy. And we really appreciate you, you know, walking us through how you approach this film.
Thank you so much.
Well, thank you, Brittany. Thank you, Ronald. It was a really great conversation.
Next, we speak to one of the most charismatic people in How to Survive a Pandemic, an Orthodox Christian priest who helps turn the tide in getting folks vaccinated in his community.
My name is Father Paul Abernathy. I'm the CEO of the Neighborhood Resilience Project, and I live in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania.
Speaking of the Neighborhood Resilience Project, tell us about the mission and how you decided to start it.
Sure. Well, the mission of the Neighborhood Resilience Project is, we say we're rooted in the gospel teachings of the Orthodox Church. We're inspired by the civil rights movement, and we seek to support the transformation of neighborhoods from what we call trauma-affected communities to resilient, healing, and healthy communities through trauma-informed community development. I had been a soldier in Iraq before I was a priest, and I had saw a lot of trauma. It was my first familiarity with the concept of post-traumatic stress disorder. When I got out of the military, ended up going into the ministry, I began to minister to people in our community, a predominantly Black community here in Pittsburgh, the Hill District, and people would start by asking for a can of food. They'd end up talking about watching their cousin gunned down in the street. They'd ask for a sweater. They'd talk about a time when they were evicted. And this went on, and I began to ponder, believing that I was seeing so much more post-traumatic stress disorder in my own community than I ever saw when I was in the Army. So we started to really focus on what would it look like to help a community heal? What would it look like to help a community build resilience? What would it look like to take some of that same organizing principles rooted in faith that guided us through civil rights and apply them right here as it related to the trauma that inundated us daily. And that was the origin of the Neighborhood Resilience Project.
So, like, how did your work change once the vaccines became available? Like, walk us through a day in your life at that time.
Well, the first thing that we did, even before the vaccine, whenever we started to experience the shutdown in March, we were hearing people say things like, well, you know, Black people can't get COVID. That was just some of the popular rhetoric
on the street.
I hadn't
heard that one.
In March of 2020. Yeah, that was just around here. People were saying things like that. There was a group of people who, they were actually having smoking parties because there was this rumor going around that if you smoked, that would fortify your lungs against the virus. So they were smoking the argila, like the hookah to help fortify the lungs. And so we were seeing these sorts of things. So what we decided to do was, we had some familiarity with an epidemiological response, and that comes from our work around gun violence. We have a trauma response team that responds to homicides as a result of gun violence. And through that work, we had some familiarity with epidemiological protocols. And we realized that we were using them treating gun violence as a disease. But we also understood that the protocols essentially were very similar, even though the disease could be different. You know, it could be Ebola, it could be AIDS, it could be COVID. So we started to adapt some of what we learned in addressing with gun violence to combating COVID. 19. And we developed what we called a core of community health deputies. So from our perspective, it was different than a community health worker in that we knew we had to deputize as many community members as we possibly could to really, combat the spread of COVID-19, support basic needs, and also to support community mental health. We had no money, of course, to do this. So we were completely dependent on volunteers. So we ended up training a core of 108 volunteers who came from 13 different predominantly Black and also some immigrant communities, what we also describe as medically underserved communities, who hit the streets in the early days of the pandemic. That core was already in place whenever Pittsburgh was selected as a trial site for the vaccine around July of that year. We realized at that time that we needed to have some diversity in the clinical trials, but we knew that would be a difficult task given the history that we had in our community with medicine. But we also knew that we could leverage these community health deputies in trying to help not convince people to enroll in clinical trials, but to give people the option, to let people know that this was happening.
How reticent were people to take the vaccines in your community?
When we really started doing this at the University of Pittsburgh in those clinical trials, there was 3% minority participation.
Wow.
And then it jumped to 8% after the community health deputies got out there. So we realized that we actually were able to have some kind of an impact. And of course, when the vaccine really did begin to roll out, it was very chaotic. And of course, December and January of 2020, 2021. And the healthcare systems that were charged with this, rolling the vaccine out, and the health department, we also knew that they didn't have the relations to really roll this out very rapidly in our community. So we were able, again, to really leverage these community health deputies and set up vaccine sites, because enrolling people or registering people for the vaccine was incredibly cumbersome in those days. The online form, the process, senior citizens were unable, many of them, to do it on their own. So we had to go through this process with them, you know, person by person. At one point, it was took a half an hour just to register one person for the vaccine.
So we want to play a clip for you that's kind of related to what you were just discussing.
When people say, and I hear, you know, I see this, I'm watching the TV, and they say, oh, you know, black folks don't trust because of Tuskegee.
Right, right.
Yes, Tuskegee was horrible. It's also not only about Tuskegee. That's the reality.
So when you're talking about vaccine hesitancy and all that, if it's not just about Tuskegee, what else is it about?
Well, there's a lot of lived experience that people of color have injustice interacting with the healthcare system. And it's important to acknowledge that. There's some extraordinary research on the topic. We can take, for example, pain medication. We know that as it relates to pain management, that people of color are less likely to be treated for pain than whites who actually exhibit the very same symptoms. But this idea that this distrust is based solely on that history is false. It's also based on the lived experience of injustice in the healthcare system in America.
So bearing all of that in mind, like, what were your strategies for helping to encourage people in your faith community to get vaccinated? Like, what worked, what didn't work as far as, you know, getting people to go take that jab?
Well, you know, the first thing was, in terms of these community health deputies, it was very important to get them in the same room with these doctors. We had to begin to build real relationships between real people. We say we don't try to convince, we try to inform. And once we inform, we empower. In a way, we were trusting that people, if they had the right information, they would make the right choice.
I wonder, what in your faith has motivated you to lead this mission as you have in your community?
Well, I would have to say love. In my faith, our God is a God of love. And in my faith, it says that we have to love one another as God loved us. People have asked me, you know, because I'm not an epidemiologist, I have no background in public health. You know, I'm a priest, I'm an Orthodox Christian priest. But what it is that love has made me a quick learner. We learned how to implement epidemiological protocols because we loved the people who were dying. We learned how to partner with physicians who were conducting clinical trials because our grandmothers were shut up in their house in deep fear because they thought if they were going to get the virus, they knew that they were going to die. We learned how to set up vaccine sites because our children hadn't been in school in a year and a half and had lost all of their after-school programs and were suffering in the streets and violence was rising. We loved them. And because we loved them, we learned. And so love makes remarkable students. And I would have to say in my own life, in my own faith, in my own ministry, this is what truly has guided me.
Oh, that was beautifully stated. I always loved the idea of the love being the driving force behind the faith. So that was beautifully stated. We want to play another clip for you, and I'll talk to you on the other side of this.
Microchips?
That's what he thinks.
There's no microchips in there.
Totally
what is it, Lay's, Doritos? What is it?
Oh, no.
You know, that's that QAnon stuff. We're not into that.
No, I can't question that.
Can I get you an answer from the Bible on this? This is what it says. Honor the physician with the honor due him. And also according to your need of him, for the Lord created him.
Now, I've been in church all my life. I am Pentecostal. I had never heard this portion before, and I had to do some Googling and found that it was in the Apocrypha. And I got pretty excited about it. I shared it with my mom, my sister. I was like, why are we not talking about this? Can you talk to us a little bit more about that, using that passage and the effect that it had on the conversations you were having?
Yes. Well, you know, unfortunately, being in the Orthodox Church, that is always included in our Bible, that, you know, those scriptures readings, what's really interesting is that people sometimes they ask, tell me where directly it says it in the Bible. We know that you can make these inferences, you know, yeah, we get you can make these degrees of connection, but show me where it says it directly. And, you know, being able to open the scriptures and point to the scriptures and show people something that's very clearly speaks to the situation, the question in their mind. For me, I thought, why not embrace that? And of all the groups that we run here at the Neighborhood Resilience Project, there is one group that gets more attendance than any other, and that is the Bible study. And so it's just a cultural thing. And so I said, well, listen, then all we have to do is use the Bible study as an opportunity to address these other challenges. So we meet people where they are, and it has here with us, you know, it's had this profound, certainly, impact.
When you shared that scripture, and I love the way you talk about it, y'all, I could almost hear you winding up and getting ready to hoop. as you shared that scripture, did you actually change any minds in the moments by sharing it? Did you see anybody make adjustments when you're kind of ministering to them in that way?
Well, you know what? I don't know that I ever saw anyone said, well, that's it, I'm going to do it. What I did see in almost every occasion is people just really stop speechless.
Okay.
You know, like that's the thing. And what happens usually is that becomes like a point of introspection where people, because what it does is it kind of challenges a broad set of world beliefs. And if you're able to sort of, it challenges a broad world view, it really causes, from my experience, some different reflection, some new reflection on that same old topic. And so I have had people that didn't, maybe not in the moment, but then they would go on to change their mind.
It meant a lot to read it because it gave me pause when I read it. I was like, we've been arguing about this for months. It's in the Bible. Let's just say it right now.
You know, here's the thing that's really, truly amazing. And it just goes to show you in America how far we get, because what a lot of people don't realize is that hospitals, as we know it, did not exist before the church. So the first hospital that we know, like the modern conception of the hospital, comes from St. Basil the Great in the 3rd century. In fact, in the ancient church, there's this class of saint. They call them holy unmercenaries, and they are all doctors who actually practice medicine among the poor for free. So there was always this close association of medicine with the church. I'm talking the early church. Mm-hmm. So it's interesting that we find ourselves in a place where Christians or some people of faith are struggling with medicine. It's just, for me, it's always about, let's go back to the roots. Let's just go back to the roots, and maybe that could help inform us today.
You know, you've spoken about engaging people and one-on-one conversations to build trust in vaccines. Why do you think these small conversations are so important in doing that?
Yeah, you know, I think there's a lot of people that honestly, they are never seen and they're never heard. The world has ignored them for so long. And I think taking the time to sit with somebody, to look them right in the face, I think taking the time and not judging them, loving them, you know, sincerely engaging them, sincerely saying, I really want to, in all sincerity, understand, help me understand why you don't want to get this vaccine. Help me understand what your fear is. Because that can be very important, not just as it relates to helping people do something that is good for their health, but it can also be a very healing moment for that person. This could be the one time where someone is really saying in their own way, I see you, I hear you, and I love you. And I think if we were to understand every personal interaction, we say, yes, it is about the vaccine in this instance. But if we understand it as an opportunity to say, I see you, I love you, and I hear you, it can be a very profound experience for that person. And the experience in and of itself could have an impact that goes well beyond any vaccine.
Father Paul, you have blown our minds. You have completely blown our minds. Thank you so much for talking with us.
Hey, you're dropping truth bombs, man. Like, this is a good interview. Yeah, this is incredible, man. Thank you.
Listen, I'm so humbled to be with both of you. It's been truly, truly such a joy. Thank you for being so kind and gracious.
So this documentary is contemporaneous with what we're living now. It's up to the minute. It's so up to the minute that there are even, you know, some things that have developed since the documentary was completed.
Okay, so the vaccination rate right now across the world is 4.84 billion people, 63% worldwide, have received at least one dose. And that's as of this recording. So could be more by the time you guys hear this.
Also at the time of this recording, the current U.S. vaccination rate is 75%. 75% of eligible people have received at least one dose of the coronavirus vaccine. And that's amazing.
75% is impressive. It's that 25% that's bothering me. Y'all slowing us down. On January 11th, 2022, experimental mRNA vaccines were shown to produce antibodies in animals, so mice and monkeys, which means that they're still progressing forward with the mRNA technology and research.
Also, a major update, everyone 5 years of age and older is now eligible to get a COVID-19 vaccination in the United States, and everyone ages 12 years and older is eligible for a booster shot. And I think we're getting closer and closer to every day is the reality that children ages 6 months through 4 years will soon be able to get vaccinated against COVID-19. It's a really big deal. And it's amazing to think of that, like, all of these updates are the direct result of the work that we saw done in that documentary.
So I think my main takeaway from Father Paul, just the idea of him being driven by love for the community and for his fellow man, just I was really in awe of some of the things that he was saying, especially when it comes to the mission that he felt like him and his organization had to their community around them.
My biggest takeaway actually from Father Paul was what he said about love making us quick learners. It was such a great encapsulation of an alternative way of thinking about like human capacity for change and how much things have had to change over the past couple of years. It also made me question why certain things that don't have to go as slowly as they've gone have gone so slowly. And it made me definitely think a little bit differently and more in depth about like why we are still where we are with the pandemic. You know, like at the heart of it, is it possibly a lack of love or loving action? I thought that was such a great framing. And with David France, the thing that really shocked me from talking to him was that I was surprised that he was surprised that the vaccine came together so quickly. You know, he had been up close watching the whole thing come together from so many different vantage points over that, you know, year or so of time, that it was really surprising to me when he said that he, you know, was in somewhat disbelief of how quickly the vaccine found to be effective and was able to be distributed.
Yes. Well, that's all we got for today.
Join us next time when we unpack the brand new docuseries, The Invisible Pilot, from directors Phil Lott and Ari Mark, about the drug smuggling Arkansas pilot who finds himself caught up in the Reagan era investigation of the Iran-Contra affair. No big deal. Normal, everyday stuff.
Regular degular.
Until then, I'm Brittany Luce.
And I'm Ronald Young Jr. And this has been HBO Docs Club.
Thanks for listening.
HBO Docs Club is a production of HBO and Pineapple Street Studios. It's hosted by me, Ronald Young Jr.
And me, Brittany Luce. Beyondria July is our lead producer, and our associate producer is Maria Robin Somerville. Additional production support from Natalie Peart.
Darby Maloney is our editor. Hannes Brown is our engineer and composer. John Asante is our senior managing producer.
And our executive producers are Barry Finkel, Jenna Weiss-Berman, and Max Linsky.
And, you know, they came in to set the cameras up and, you know, the correspondent, nationally recognized correspondent on the other end. And, you know, an elderly woman in the community and the crew was saying, please, please, we have an interview. And she said to them, I don't care about your interview. I'm trying to find out what time church starts. And she interrupted